Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Alyssa Lee Colgenin. The locally based, internationally renowned violinist performs Shostakovich's first violin concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center on Wednesday. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at playwright Aaron Posner's adaptation for the stage of Haim Potok's novel My Name is Asher Lem. The project is in development at the Playpen Conference in Philadelphia. We take a peek at a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, featuring the works of three post-war German artists. And Susan Lewis takes us to a modern incarnation of the ancient art of storytelling, as she visits Philadelphia's first-person arts Story Slam. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Born in the United States to a Korean mother and a Finnish father, Philadelphia-based violinist Alyssa Lee Colgenin's early years were spent in Hong Kong and Korea. She returned to the U.S. at age 11 to study violin at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Since graduating, her playing has taken her all over the world, in collaborations with leading orchestras and major conductors. These include recitals in London, Amsterdam, and Salzburg, as a soloist with the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and symphonies in Helsinki and Seoul, Korea. Alyssa Lee Colgenin's husband is Roberto Diaz, former Philadelphia Orchestra principal viola, and now president of the Curtis Institute. On Wednesday, she's the soloist for a performance of the Shostakovich First Violin Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Music Center. I met with Alyssa Lee Colgenin earlier this week in Philadelphia and first asked her if playing with a group of musicians so familiar was easier or more difficult than performing with strangers.
I think it makes it easier, certainly makes it more fun. I love, you know, looking around and seeing my friends, and I certainly feel the support there, and I know everyone's wishing me well, and you know, I like to run through things sometimes, so I've had some of my friends come over already, and that's very, you know, comforting and just great fun to know that they're there and we're all having a good time playing together. So I think it's definitely a positive thing. I enjoy it.
Tell me a little bit about your relationship with the repertoire, with the Shostakovich Violin Concerto.
Well, it's actually my first time playing it, and I tremendously looking forward to it. It's such a great, great piece. It's really one of the greatest violin concertos ever written, I think, and it lays wonderfully with the violin, and it's very well balanced with the orchestra. It's a great violinist's piece. You know, you can just have a great time playing it, and it's got so many colors, and it's a very dark piece overall, but it's certainly, you know, it's not dark in the sense of somber through the whole piece. It has a lot of sarcasm and a lot of upbeatness to it, but it's a challenging but such a gratifying piece to play on the violin. It's just a load of fun to play, and it is my first time, so I'm very much looking forward to playing it.
That interesting cadenza as well between the second last and the final movement.
Quite the cadenza, yeah. Shostakovich apparently wrote the piece intending for there to be no break between the cadenza and the last movement, and I think Oistrakh begged him, you know, to give him a little chance to at least wipe the, you know, the sweat from his brow, and I'm appreciative to Mr. Oistrakh for having done that, because, you know, you do need to take a little bit of a breath after that. Playing it, it's great. It just builds up in such an incredible way. Truly the greatest cadenza written for violin, I'm sure, you know.
Talk to me about the dynamic of playing in this summer festival atmosphere. You've done some of this before.
I think it's definitely more relaxed. I've never played at the Mann Center before, but it's certainly inducive to relaxation and, you know, looking at everybody's having a nice time, you know, enjoying the 98-degree weather with their bottles of wine and their picnics. It's a wonderful relaxed.
Will you be relaxed, though? Do you suffer from pre-stage nerves?
I wouldn't say I'm ever really relaxed when I go on stage. Sometimes I become more relaxed as I'm playing, and I always hope for that. But, you know, you go into concert zone where you have a different kind of a concentration, and you're relaxed on a different level. It's hard to explain. But certainly not relaxed if I was out there in the audience having the bottle of wine. I would probably be more relaxed. I'm certainly having a great time.
The Nocturne in C-sharp of Frédéric Chopin, Alyssa Lee Kolginin violin with Robert Koning on piano. Kolginin is the soloist for the Wednesday evening performance of the Shostakovich First Violin Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Music Center.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Playpen, a Philadelphia-based new stage drama development organization, is presently holding its third annual conference, providing resources for six playwrights as they continue molding their works in progress. The conference culminates this weekend with staged readings of the new plays. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, one of these works is a beloved story that local audiences will one day have the chance to see as a fully staged production.
Commissioned by the Arden Theatre, Chaim Potok's 1972 novel My Name is Asher Lev is being adapted as a play by writer and director Aaron Posner. This isn't Posner's first adaptation, but it is the first adaptation he's undertaken as part of the Playpen Conference. Paul Meshedjian, founding artistic director of Playpen, says he struggled with whether or not to include the piece.
were about new work, and I had to wonder to myself whether this counted in, you know, in effect as a new play, since it was an adaptation of an already written work. But I just thought that this is a different form. It's a theatrical form, and in the end, it will be its own animal. I just bit the bullet and said, you know, it's worthwhile to me because I think this is something that people want to be exposed to, and the theater is a good place for that to happen.
That local audiences want to be exposed to this play is a fair assumption. Chaim Potok, who died in 2002, is an internationally celebrated author who studied at the University of Pennsylvania and made his home just outside of Philadelphia. He wrote novels, plays, children's books, and other nonfiction works. Potok's very first published book, The Chosen, was an award-winning bestseller. It explores the friendship and rivalry between two Jewish boys, one a modern Orthodox Jew and the other from a Hasidic Jewish community in Brooklyn. Aaron Posner, who specializes in bringing literary works to the stage, adapted The Chosen for the Arden Theater in Philadelphia in 1999. During that development process, Posner worked closely with Potok. In contrast to other writers, Posner explains that Potok, though an exceptional storyteller, was not a flashy writer.
I am certainly drawn to more pyrotechnic writers at times and people who achieve spectacular literary effect and where the language is sort of rich and evocative in certain, like, highly theatrical ways. And that's not Potok. That's not what he did. His language is plain and simple in some ways and very direct. But I think that directness, that sort of open-handed approach to writing, carries a powerful both emotional, intellectual, and spiritual impact.
Many of Potok's stories deal with the tensions between religion, in particular Judaism, and the values of modern culture. Adina Potok, Chaim Potok's wife of 44 years, says his work was very much about cultivating respect between differing viewpoints.
He was not presenting good against evil. He was presenting a good in conflict with another good. And how do we deal with it? How do we deal with it within a family? How do we deal with it with friends? How do we deal with it in communities?
My Name is Asher Lev is a prime example of the conflict Adina Potok describes. The story centers on a child artist prodigy, Asher Lev, who was born into a Hasidic Jewish family. His parents view his art as foolish, even sacrilegious. Thus, he's confronted with the anguish of trying to honor his family and community while being true to himself and his undeniable gift as a painter. According to Adina Potok, the genesis of the Asher Lev story is rooted in Chaim Potok's own experiences as a child, when he was honing his skills as a painter, and his father demanded he stop. Potok wondered what would have happened if he hadn't complied with his father's wishes and had continued to paint as a boy. This musing was the impetus of the Asher Lev novel. Adina Potok recalls her husband writing the book feverishly during the summer of 1971 while in Israel.
He just about finished it when we were in Jerusalem that summer. He really tucked it in when we came back. And then I remember bringing it over to Bob Gottlieb, who was then editor at Knopf. And Bob sat up and he read through the night. And we kind of dozed a little bit in chairs, and then Bob came and he said, "It's a book."
And the book went on to be a success, and is today still commonly found on high school reading lists. As Aaron Posner works on his adaptation of Asher Lev, nearly 10 years after adapting The Chosen, he notes Potok is the first author he's ever adapted twice. He says he feels strongly drawn to the story.
Right from the beginning, I went, "I don't know how you adapt this for the stage," because The Chosen is relatively easy relative to Asher Lev. The Chosen is there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of drama, there's a lot of scenes, and a handleable number of characters at the core. Asher Lev is a completely different kind of novel, and one that I think defies adaptation in some ways, yet invites it in some other important ways. And so it literally took me more than 5 years of just letting it bounce around in my mind before I began to sort of see a way that I could adapt it emerge.
Posner says his work on the Asher Lev play benefits a great deal from his collaboration with Chaim Potok on The Chosen.
Obviously, the experience of having worked with him and to have his voice in my head still and what he cared about, and I know that if I veer towards the sentimental, I will hear his voice in my head saying, "You can't do that," you know. That was a terrible imitation, by the way. So, you know, that's very helpful. And the other wonderful thing is that his wife, Adina Potok, is still here in this area, and she and I have talked about this book a number of times, and she is an invaluable resource as well.
My name is not Chaim Potok. My name is Adina Potok. But I think of all people, I probably have the most intimate connection to his mind.
Adina Potok says as she's consulted for the Asherlev play and gives input into its development, she doesn't merely offer her own opinions.
I find sometimes that I'm almost channeling him because we really talk to each other about lots of stuff. The world, thought, art, obviously our kids, our parents. We knew each other's gestalts.
Despite initial reservations by the playpen organizers to include Asherlev in this year's conference, Aaron Posner, Adina Potok, and others continue to collaborate to develop the new play. No premiere date for the fully staged production of My Name is Asherlev at the Arden Theater has yet been set.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. As part of the Playpen Conference, the first public reading of My Name is Asherlev is at the Adrian Theater in Philadelphia at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art examines the work of three German artists working in the second half of the 20th century. Kiefer, Polk and Richter, which opens today, is the third installment of the museum's notation series of rotating projects that explore various approaches to contemporary art. The show includes works by Anselm Kiefer, Sigmar Polke and Gerhard Richter from the museum's collection, as well as loans from private and other collections in the area. I visited the exhibition yesterday with Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of contemporary art, Carlos Basualdo. Besides their nationality and the time period they lived and live in, what else ties these three German 20th century artists together?
Well, you know, both Sigmar Polke and Gerhard Richter, they were working together very closely at the beginning of their careers. And they were part of what, with Conrad Fischer, or something called capitalist realism. Capitalist realism was some sort of response to pop, which was the dominant movement at the time in the 60s. And so it was their way of coping with the realities of Western Germany and the West in general. Kiefer comes a little bit later in the picture, and he was never close, that I know, to Polke and Richter in the way they were really working together. They were
Went to school together.
Yes, and for a period of time they were really, you know, experimenting with similar themes, and Kiefer from the beginning was very obviously coming after them and learning. He had learned from their experiences, but he shared with them an interest in painting, and that's something that now that there's so many younger people that are, you know, very interested in painting again, and the art world seems to be receptive to that, seems kind of obvious. But the truth is that in the 70s, when the art world started to be more and more dominated by conceptual practices, to have practices that were consistently about painting was kind of an exception. And I think that's what gathered these three people together. They were working with some, you know, they share some similar concerns, but in terms of their relationship with certain imagery, the form, the dimensions of the of their work, the exploration of the medium, but mostly this, you know, this concern with the possibilities of painting after, you know, conceptual art, after pop art, that it gathers them together.
Were they actively rebelling against the idea of high-minded art, of art for the brain rather than art for the soul and for the heart?
I think that they also want to be very eloquent, and they want to talk about history. I mean, the three of them are very concerned about history, and how could not they be working and living in Germany after the war? I mean, but they dealt with history in very different ways.
But it has to be also said that the work that they produced is very beautiful, very aesthetically pleasing.
It is very beautiful. I think that the interesting thing is that they sort of arrive at beauty. I mean, I think it's not an expected beauty. In some cases, it's a completely unexpected beauty. Like Polke is a good example. I mean, he uses colors that are not beautiful per se in some of the pieces, but they suddenly become kind of amazing. He sort of makes the image emerge in front of your eyes, and that captures you, and that's what we call beauty. And the same thing happens with Richter. I mean, you know, from the early pictures in which he was basically basing the image on photographs, I think that he makes, they are invested in the construction of a new way of understanding beauty. I think that's very much in their minds. For them, let's say beauty is not a point of departure, but a point of arrival.
Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of contemporary art, Carlos Basualdo. Kiefer, Polka, and Richter runs through November 25th. Scientists believe storytelling dates from the beginning of human existence as a way to communicate, pass on cultural traditions, and entertain. Even today, peel away the special effects and high technology from a good contemporary movie or flashy Broadway show, and you'll find a story that someone wants to tell. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to an incarnation of this ancient art form that goes back to basics, a night of storytelling known as the first-person art story slam.
It's a dark and steamy summer night on a small street in Philadelphia. People are streaming up the steps to a second-floor bar at 6th and Bainbridge. Just inside the door stands a man with a handful of forms and a pen. His name is Dan Gashevsky.
When people walk in, they have the option to sign a release form if they want to tell a story on stage or to sign up to judge the stories.
Dan Gashevsky is operations manager for First Person Arts. We're at the third monthly story competition, or SLAM, held at L'Etage, an intimate wine bar with one of two rooms adjacent to the bar slightly elevated, making a perfect stage. The lights are low and the space is packed with people, standing at the bar and seated at small tables. That this event draws such a crowd was a surprise and a relief to First Person Arts president Vicky Solot, who had her concerns as the first story slam in April drew near.
Nobody was calling and asking about it, and I thought, it's going to be me and the bartender. We got there, and there was like this crush of people arriving, and by 8:30, when we were about to start, we were turning people away.
First Person Arts is an organization founded on the idea that sharing personal stories is a way to connect with one another. Its anchor event is a yearly festival of memoir and documentary art, presenting talks, recitals, performances, screenings, and exhibitions of personal art. The Story Slam grew out of a desire to create more activities during the year that would engage the group's growing community of enthusiasts.
Part of what we decided we were going to really emphasize this year was to create things that were more interactive and more opportunities for people who don't necessarily classify themselves as a writer or a photographer, or they haven't necessarily yet built skills, but they have something to share and an interesting story to tell.
And so the Story Slam was born. This year, seven monthly Story Slams lead to a grand slam that will occur during the First Person Arts Festival in November. Each month at the door is a hat or bucket for names of anyone with a story and the courage to tell it to a room full of strangers. Angel Hogan signed up early, perhaps too early, at the third Story Slam.
About 15 minutes after I put my name in the bucket, the room just filled up and it was packed. So I thought, oh man, maybe this wasn't the best decision because I thought it would be much more low-key, and then it ended up so crowded, so I was very, very, very nervous. And then I thought, well, at the very least, I'll hear what other people are doing.
And then the first name was called.
I'm grabbing one at random. It's either Angel or Angel. Hogan. Is Angel or Angel Hogan here? Where?
Angel. Rick Nichols, food columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, was the amiable master of ceremonies for the third Story Slam. In the whimsical spirit of the evening, he cradled a giant styrofoam avocado under his arm, which he hinted he might give away to a particularly inspiring storyteller. Before starting, he read the rules. Each story must be told without notes, be no more than 5 minutes long, be true, and somehow be related to the prescribed theme, which this month was boiling point. One by one, names are called, and the stories unfold.
One of the greatest gifts I got when I was about 8 was a rooster, and I carried him around like a baby because he was my pride and joy.
We held the dubious distinction of being the 2 worst alto saxophone players in our junior high band.
It seems to me most of my boiling point stories, and I thought of a lot this week, are all related in some way to that first boyfriend.
Who are all these storytellers vying for the chance to tell their tales? Turns out that there are lots of storytellers among us. Kendra Gaeta, a project planner, was the winner of the second Story Slam.
I'm a talker, first of all. I'm the youngest of 4 kids, so I think that if ever I needed somebody to listen to my idea, I always had to sell it pretty good.
But telling a story like this on stage is not quite the same.
I was really sweating it. When I came in, I was nervous, and I was sure that I was going to go up and leave out some crucial detail and get to the end of it and be like, oh, wait a minute.
Similarly, writer Angel Hogan was used to creating stories.
But not necessarily sharing them in this way. Like, I have done readings before, but it's been like reading from the page. So that was a stretch for me just to get up and tell a story kind of off the cuff.
Many of these true stories are funny, if not a bit outrageous. Kendra Gaeta's winning story the second month was about her absconding with an undergarment from the house of a celebrity. Less risque, but still quirky, Angel Hogan's story was one of growing up on a farm with a very aggressive pet rooster.
It's a funny story, I think, to hear me tell in particular because I don't necessarily look like the type of person that would have an attack rooster.
It seems natural to go for laughs, and some people may live their lives with an eye for what's funny, like Kendra Gaeta.
I will find myself in a totally weird situation, and I'll be, what can I do to make this a little bit weirder? And then just go from there because it's just going into your story bank.
Each of us may have a story to tell, but not everyone wants to get up and tell a room full of strangers. First-person president Vicky Solat says that while many of the early stories were shocking or sensational, as time goes on, more people are sharing personal accounts that are just as powerful. Solat was delighted at how supportive the audiences are, as was the case with one storyteller in particular.
This woman was like shaking in her boots. She was so nervous. And she came up and told this very personal, poignant, a little bit bittersweet story. And this audience was completely with her. It had been a little bit about loneliness and so forth, and there was some kind of tie-in with salsa dancing. And there was another guy who had told a story earlier also about salsa dancing, and when she finished her story, he came rushing up on the stage and started dancing with her.
9-4 from judge number 1.
After every story ends, the MC calls on each of 3 judges, whose names are also chosen from a hat.
Judge number 2. We got an 8.
Scoring is from 1 to 10 with points for crafting, presentation, adherence to the time limit, and relationship to the theme.
Judge number 3, a 9. Really high scores.
After 10 stories have been told, the storyteller with the most points wins. The monthly winners will compete at the Grand Story Slam in November, held as part of the annual First Person Arts Festival. On the one hand, this is serious storytelling. First Person Arts even sponsored a workshop to teach people the craft, how to shape a story with a strong beginning, an arc in the middle, and an ending. Yet, despite the instruction and the competition, winning isn't everything.
I think these personal narratives and the way we see our own lives and the way we fit ourselves into the world around us is really important.
It's so much bigger than what it might seem like initially. I think it fosters community. I think even in that room during the night of the slam, like everybody was there together.
Gathering together to tell stories. We've been doing it since before recorded time. No matter how many iPods or laptops or big screen TVs we own, nothing beats listening to someone tell a good story. At a bedside, around the campfire, or in a neighborhood bar. Oh, and although she didn't win the most points that evening, Angel Hogan went home with MC Rick Nichols' Giant Avocado.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The theme of the 4th First Person Story Slam is miseducation. The competition takes place this Tuesday at Latage at 6th and Bainbridge Streets in Philadelphia. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Elizabeth Flynn, Catherine Brown, Debbie Fleischman, Ariel Levitis, and Megan Wendell. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Great. Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.